Well, he's a writer, a director, an actor. He studied at NIDA, graduating in 1999. He has a long list of credits. I've seen him in Reuben Guthrie, Hamlet, Strange Interlude of Belvoir, Travesties at STC back in 2009. There's so many TV credits, theatre credits, writing credits. I'll let him get into a bit more of those in just a minute. Welcome, Toby Schmitz.
Hello. Lovely to be here.
Lovely to have you. Now you're performing nightly at the Old Fitz, doing live performance. Says to camera every night of the week at 7:30, and it's quite a dance with something like 9 cameras. You dance around and perform, and this is in a beautiful black and white. It's sleek. It's Tom Paine, based on nothing by Will Eno, and it's a Red Line production. We're going to get into that in just a minute, but before we do, I want to get to know a little bit about how you got to where you are now. So you were born in Perth. What was life like for you growing up? Were your parents creative?
Yeah, look, maybe a lot of people have this experience. My life was idyllic as a child and completely traumatic. I mean, is that not a large chunk of our childhood? You know, Perth's a fairly isolated place. It was full of warmth and adventure and a certain amount of privilege and all the things that childhood contain in wherever you grow up. My parents are undoubtedly creative. My father directed before I was born, you know, at university, and then at various Perth theatre companies. By the time I was born, my father was teaching, and my mother and he had opened a secondhand bookstore, which in those days largely catered to the University of Western Australia crowd.
Elizabeth's Bookstores,
that's right, which turned into a sort of a fistful of them, some of them here in Sydney. So in that sense, yeah, there was creativity everywhere, especially on the bookshelves, you know, at home and in the stores. It was always encouraged. You know, yeah, if there was an area of creativity that I wanted to know more about, or the humanities, be it history or poetry or whatever, I was often just pointed to the appropriate bookshelf in the store.
Well, sometimes you go to the opposite direction of your parents. Or when did you first sort of start acting, and did you start as an actor?
From year dot, I don't remember a time not performing. It was always a calling for me, whether that was, you know, insisting my parents listen to me, you know, recite Roald Dahl's Revolting Rhymes, or I don't remember it not being a part of my life. I remember some sort of like after school care, you know, as a very small person. It was like a clowning thing, you know, like clowning daycare. Like we went into street performing. I don't remember it being forced upon me, but rather accepted and encouraged by my parents. You know, so I remember my father was teaching still at the time, putting on a high school production of Oliver. Remains a favoured musical. You know, I recently just introduced it to my 4-year-old daughter, the movie, which I remember my dad and mum saying, you're going to love this, and I did. And she's addicted to it. And I find myself, you know, cooking dinner and she's listening to it, like mouthing the words still. I remember that playing a large part in sparking something. But it was always kind of there.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was a natural progression for you to come, to Sydney. And how did you come to Sydney and then NIDA? And did you, you know?
Well, it's been a natural progression. I always kind of deferred to it and did it in my extracurricular hours. I was forever trying to get up my own, sketch comedy, just sort of goon show.
Right.
You know, in the lunch hour and commandeering the school drama department. And which was pretty small, actually, in my slightly cloistered, strange school. I think there was only like 3 or 4 kids in it by the end of year 11 or 12. And it wasn't an examinable subject at that point. But meanwhile, the neighbouring sort of boys' school had a very good youth theatre department and still does. And cool cats like Tim Minchin and so on were hanging out there. So I sort of defected. I started playing hooky a bit and going over to this other school and hanging around until they let me in. So I always sort of chased it. And then straight after school, at the true expense of a law arts degree, I started doing stand-up, which was a sort of a a sort of brave, I don't know, a move for me. Like, I didn't really know what I was doing, but I sort of get the train into Northbridge at, you know, 18 and do stand up. And also the University Dramatic Society at UWA was filled with wonderful cats who still are kicking around in all corners of the industry. And, you know, pursued that. And then I got into NIDA. And if there was ever a turning point, I don't think it was quite a turning point, but like a big stepping stone, it was coming to Sydney, suddenly being very dedicated to only one thing, and that was the performing arts amongst a whole lot of people who were doing the same.
So you started as an actor. When was this sort of transition? You were kind of around a lot, and then it feels a bit like you disappeared. Did you go overseas? Did you, you know,
I was in a coma for 4 years. No. Yeah, I suppose that's your take on it.
I'm from the outside, like as a theatre goer.
I went to a US TV show that was shot in South Africa for 4 years, 6 months of each year. But I was coming back and doing quite a lot, as much as I could in those other 6 months. But yeah, I got a good gig, you know. I hustled up an audition. I was like, give me the pirate audition. And the agents were like, man, it's a pretty butch show. I'm not sure they're interested. And I was like, I was hungry, you know, I wasn't doing anything. I said, please, just give me an audition. And I got the damn thing. And it suddenly turned into this sort of quite large experience for me. So that took me out of the Australian system for a bit.
Is that something, let me just ask you about that. Is that something that's important to be a little bit pushy?
I've never been good at it and therefore have patted myself squarely on the back anytime I have done it and it has paid off.
Yeah.
I mean, each to their own. You know, I know people who hustle so charmingly. That makes you feel like they genuinely got the gig on someone else's merit. It's never been my forte. I find it a bit unclassy, but I just go red faced and stammer a bit. I used to have a theory, and I sometimes still subscribe to it, especially when I was starting out, that I would allow myself. I'm speaking completely about theatre, which is really where my heart is, and it's been my main bread and butter. That I would let myself write one letter a year. And I would draft it and handwrite it, which now seems kind of so quaint in the digital age, on nice, you know, classy bond paper to a director or to an artistic director and say, I see this play is in your lineup. I've long wanted to do it, you know, and send it. And sometimes that would actually pay off. But to answer your question, I think it is important. But on your own terms, as long as you can sleep at night, you know?
So do you have those aspirations to play particular characters? I mean, you played Hamlet. I mean, that's got to be like a big tick.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, twice. Thank you very much. And again, you know, I think that.
Yeah.
I think anyone who's played Hamlet kind of walks off stage from the last performance. Going, give me one more crack.
I remember seeing it actually at Belvoir, and Benito actually reminded me that while you were sitting there, because you had all those chairs around the edge and you were sitting there, and someone in the audience got up and slid over and took a photo, and you like turned in character kind of and went, really, or seriously, or something like that. Like, what, you know, what is that interaction with the audience, and do you have that much, like, people kind of responding back to you?
Well, it's a wonderful thing about theater, isn't it? And I think maybe because my early, you know, experiences were in stand-up, where
it's all about that.
Yeah, you need to have that give and take. I've never really been able to ditch that or want to. And the great thing about Shakespeare is it begs that interaction. You can imagine the bear pit of the day in Elizabethan times. You know, like, if your actor wasn't able to cop a bit of thrown fruit or be able to answer back, you know, they would have, you know, not survived a minute on stage. And I think the great plays have an ability to withstand a certain flexibility. And I've never been one for thinking about the fourth wall as being breakable. My experience up on stage or in an audience is that it's not that fragile. It's far more porous and flexible and osmotic, I think.
You still have control.
Yeah, and the audience wants the show to go on. You know, I've been in productions where the revolve stops, someone has broken a limb on stage.
Oh,
I was
going to
a play where someone dried and could not remember their line for like 5 minutes, which feels like, you know, half an hour in stage time, and it was the last monologue of the play, so no one could sort of jump in and save the poor actor. And you know what, the audience just doubles down and goes, this is going to work. you know, nothing breaks. It's kind of like, and everyone remembers that night. You know. Yeah, I'm very fond of winking at the audience, or if they want to cough on right in the middle of To Be or Not To Be, to give them a withering look, or if a phone goes off. Some plays are not suitable for it. I've attempted it in plays, you know, a couple of Louis Naur's beautiful boys trilogies. Someone would do something awful, you know, be on the phone or you know, something or other. And I would attempt it and I go, no, this naturalism is too fierce for me to push the fourth wall like that. But, you know, the importance of being earnest or something or other, it's kind of begging for some for Lady Bracknell to address someone's phone going on.
Do you think there needs to be more of that?
Yes. Well, it's all about whether you're up for... Look, I know about some actors who, like, I can't believe you're looking them in the eye, you know. And I know some actors who are like me, who are like, I've got to stop, like, checking out the good-looking person in row three. I totally lost my lines. You know, like, should there be more of it? Well, each to their own.
But I mean that interaction, like the audience, you know.
Anyway, aren't they? I mean, it's so interesting. Tom Payne.
Well, you're listening to Stages. I'm Regina Botrus, and I am talking with Toby Schmitz. He is performing every evening in Tom Payne at the Old Fitz Theatre or Red Line Productions. The play is about talking to the audience, isn't it? That's the kind of whole...
It's a soliloquy rather than a monologue or a play even over a soliloquy. And a soliloquy being really a dialogue with the audience. You know, Hamlet says in What a Rogue and Peasant Slave, am I a coward? Now, if he asked that to himself or to the gods, it never works as well as like turning to someone in row five going, am I a coward? I mean, that's how it would have been done. So Tom Payne is very much that, and even more literally so. Audience members are addressed. Someone walks out. You know, he keeps pulling the rug on what audience interaction means. Now, double down on that in ISO plague times where there is no one in the audience. Andrew Henry, the co-director and artistic director at Redline, and I have done a lot of work in working out what that might mean. And interestingly, as soon as we got the cameras up and started doing it, it all started making sense. Like not too much theoretical work had to be done about what does it mean to do this play without an audience, because one of the many things that Tom Payne is about, and I just adore the play and always have, is about isolation and about an existential crisis. And what if you are the last person on earth or you are completely alone?
It is very Hamlet meets Beckett.
Oh, totally. It's such a clever piece.
Beautiful.
And well-deserved of its popularity and success. But it's really interesting in terms of audience is that what I've discovered over the last few days doing it, because, you know, it's only gone live the last two nights, and finally a couple of days ago the camera guys stopped shuffling around and murmuring, and, you know, like... Two nights ago, it was pin drop silence, and it felt good to do and freeing and weird and all these things came. But what I've been begging for the last couple of nights is notes from the director who's, you know, busy, but he's got like, this bit was good. You know, you don't have to do that. Maybe lean a little left on camera five on this, so on. But it's reminded me, actually educated me about how much the audience directs you. And I was just talking to my good chum Ewan Leslie a couple of hours ago about this, and you know, yeah, did the laugh, did the gag get a laugh? Might be the most obvious, you know, sort of example of it. If it got a laugh, great. The next night it gets a less laugh, so you shore it up. The third night it gets a bigger laugh, and you start to get a body memory of, you know, pause there so they don't lose the next line because there's probably going to be a laugh. And then suddenly some matinee comes along when no one laughs and you're left sort of, you know, your balls in the breeze and you're like, okay, so anything could happen. But it's not just that. What I've learned over the last 48 hours is the audience, a live audience, directs you and teaches you for everything. You have subconscious and peripheral body memory of they somehow got bored on that line. The story didn't hit the back row there. I should put a consonant, I should hit my T on the end of that word. I'm going too fast, I'm going too slow. All these things they teach you that I've been like, I've staggered out of, you know, the Old Fitz the last two nights into a deserted Woolloomooloo, cold, can't get an Uber because no one wants to go there. You know, going, this is so weird. And come home going, I am bereft of notes. I need to know if things worked, not just the gags. So fortunately, I've been able to sort of hook up a way to watch the show back before it gets deleted and sent into the ether. So I can at least go...
Your own notes.
Yeah, it's a totally brave new world. But
I assume you've got, like, cameramen, though, aren't they?
Most of the cameras are fixed with various focal points set, and it's being switched and run from just under the bleachers by a fabulous little team. And two of the cameras up in the bleachers in the gods in the back row of the fits are manned, yeah.
Do you want to just tell anyone listening that what you know, the kind of core of the play, the story, the nothingness of nothing?
How would you summarize that play? Everyone who's tried has come a cropper. I mean, I remember recently reading the original New York Times Isherwood review of it when it came out, 2012, and even Isherwood, you know, grand master of summarizing a play, kind of comes a cropper. He ends up quoting it, mimicking it, saying, you got to see it, you know. But I suppose one of my, you know, it is a man playing with an audience, trying to make sense of his life and theirs with a whole lot of theatre tricks, incredible wordplay, but nothing too flowery or poetic in the ornate sense. All the building blocks of the play are words we use every day. If you say, I don't know, it can be said so many different ways. You really not know? Do you know? Are you begging to know? You know, I suppose what it's been condensing for me the last couple of weeks is that I think it's a play about how to keep things alive, whether that's yourself, an idea, a performance, the audience, a word, your memories, hope, you know.
It is all of that kind of stream of consciousness too, going into storytelling, getting distracted. Is it completely choreographed? Because it's from the outside, it's hard to tell. You've got all these cameras around you and you're moving between them, and sometimes you see the shadow of you.
It's as rigorous blocked as any play. And because it's essentially in the round, we have cameras all around. It's even more so and even more specifically lit because it's not a proscenium. And with the idea of a certain messiness being one of the many tricks in it, that he just found that camera in time, or was the camera out of focus just for a second too long. It's all mapped into it to give a sense of immediacy and to emulate, I suppose, or how one does watch the theatre. You do lose moments. There are moments that aren't the best eyeline for you. It's been a fascinating and very fun adventure in how to marry what sort of a live TV broadcast with a sense of cinema with live performance. And all I can say about that process is, my instincts were right in pitching this play to Andrew, that I can't think of too many other bits of theatre or plays that suit that amalgam, that adventure so well.
It is a very big bridge, not a bridge, but it's in between that live and that. It's a fascinating experience, and I recommend anyone getting online and helping the theatre keep active. So theatre is your first love then, because you've gone on and you write plays as well, and you've been in television and film, and you know, so you always, it's your first love, is it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I feel ill when I'm away from it too long. But you don't have to be away from it too long. You know.
If you're lucky.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. But you can get a play up with your friend.
Mm.
You can read Shakespeare or Stoppard or Dorothy Hewitt or whatever floats your boat by yourself. And indeed, that's what I did all my youth. And indeed, that's what I still do now. I saw a gap, you know, a large, never-ending gap. And I said, well, I need theatre. So at expense to me and my life, I picked up a play and went and hustled up a little box to do it in. And I have no doubt been fortunate in getting some main stage stuff post-Snyder. But, you know, if lucky, one a year, two in the really cool years, which pays for 20% of your Sydney rent per annum. So if you're lucky, is part of it. But if you love theatre and you want to be in theatre, you kind of already are, is my feeling.
Have you, has there been anyone, this is the last question, have, is there anyone that has like been a mentor to you or someone that has helped you along? I think it's important to thank the people that, I don't know, guide us sometimes, and I just wonder.
I think the guides are really, really important. Mentor or someone I kind of want to be like. Someone I sort of want to be like, that's never happened. It's not really in my genes. Like, I want what they've got. But boy, no. I've had some mentors and guides. Yes. After my parents, you know, very important, rare, but very important high school teachers who sort of secretly went, yeah, keep doing that. You're not bad at that. You know, Tim Minchin was very important to me in my teen years, who was a couple of years older than me, who, you know, quite simply just said, keep at it, despite being a kid himself at the time. Prolific one. And then at NIDA, I started to meet contemporaries who did the same thing for me. Actually, while I was at law school, I remember Jeremy Sims being a someone who'd done it, you know, a generation above me, but he got out of Perth and got out of law school and gone to NIDA and was doing stuff. I remember going, well, maybe that's feasible. But then the guides, they come at you from left, right and center, don't they? I mean, people like great directors like Richard Cottrell and Judy Davis and David Bertolt were all so important to me in my earlier years straight out of NIDA, but so were my like Leland Keane and Brendan Cowell and eventually Simon Stone and things like that. Like, I think the guides are there waiting for you. And if you don't get to actually brush shoulders with them or have the discipline, wherewithal slash luck to actually get in the same room with them or to get on the phone with them, then the guides remain, as they did in my early days, in the collected works of Clive James. Or, God forbid, Shakespeare's canon, or the poems of Sylvia Plath, or whatever floats your boat, the smashing the, you know, reruns of the Golden Girls. Like, your guides are kind of there.
Mm. Okay. Well, Toby Smith, thank you so much on that note. I will let you carry on and prepare for another evening in the theatre.
In the vacuum.
Thanks for joining me.
Not at all. Thank you, Regina.
Well, that was Toby Schmitz, performer, writer, director, and you can catch him every evening in Redline Productions' Tom Paine, based on nothing. It is an absolutely beautiful production with an outstanding design, 9 cameras. You can get online every evening at 7:30 or on Saturday at 11:30, you can also catch it. It's really one not to miss. Redline Production are doing in so many interesting things. So check them out. Get online. If you can pay something, then please do. The theatre is really struggling at the moment, as we all know. So I'm here to keep talking about theatre where I can.